Okay, good afternoon, and welcome to the 2019 Conference on World Affairs, Day 4. Today is Friday, April 12th, 2019. It's 1:30 p.m., and this panel is number 4402, A Laughing Matter, The Role of Comedy in Social Change. My name is Jim England. I'll be the panel's moderator today, and that means that my only job is to present the panelists and then get out of their way. My only other job is to field y'all's questions. And if you've been here for panels earlier in the week, you know the drill. You can submit your question digitally via the CWA app, which may or may not be working. And in any case, you can go old school and get the eye of one of our CWA staffers in the aisles and write your question down in a Luddite fashion with pencil and paper. Please keep your questions brief and indicate if you're a student. We'll try to give student questions a priority. We'll try to have 15 to 20 minutes at the end of the panel for those questions. Two other housekeeping matters. Please silence all your phones. I was at a panel earlier this week and a couple of cell phones went off. We had to call campus security. There were arrests. It was an ugly scene. We don't want that here. And the other announcement is that, unfortunately, due to the snow, the party that was scheduled for today at 4:30 on the Hill has been canceled.
Oh.
However, Hill restaurants are offering an extended happy hour, so go nuts. It is my genuine pleasure to introduce today's remarkable panelists. First, to my left, Seth Shostak. Seth is an astronomer with SETI and has written the standard text on astrobiology. To put that into perspective, on one of his guest appearances on the old Colbert Report, Seth described his job at SETI as being like Jodie Foster in the movie Contact. Well, Colbert immediately pounced and said, "So you're acting. You're acting as if you actually like Matthew McConaughey." Seth hosts SETI's weekly podcast and radio show, Big Picture Science. There was an episode last month discussing whether political activism was good or bad for science. So he'll now be able to explain whether humor is good or bad for social change. Please welcome Seth back for a return engagement with CWA. No, not yet. Introduce everybody. Seth has been here before. To Seth's left, Ty Tashiro is a psychologist and a social scientist. He's the author of two books, one about social awkwardness and the other about how to choose a great long-term life mate. He says that only one of those is autobiographical. Dr. Tashiro, it appears that one of your real-world experiences has actually formed the basis for a bit in a Simpsons episode. I understand that in grade school, you distributed Valentine's Day cards to your little classmates, but you carefully crossed out all the I love yous and replaced it with I like yous. I think Ralph Wiggum used that. Ty, of course, is a former CU professor, but despite that, he keeps coming back to the CWA. And so please welcome his return to Boulder. By the way, Seth and Ty have been paired up on a number of different panels, including one just this morning, right? You guys have the same agent or something? And they actually cut their CWA comedy chops a couple of years ago when they both appeared on the panel, Sex with Robots, What's Not to Like?
Is that true?
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah.
To Ty's left, Lisa Graves, a combination attorney, investigative journalist, and social activist. Lisa, when I've looked at the list of some of the recent targets of your investigative work, Brett Kavanaugh, Tucker Carlson, Herman Cain, the Koch brothers, the guys at ALEC, those helpful altruists are helping write all of our state laws. I just know you've got some killer comedic material lined up for us today. What a bunch of cut-ups, right?
Yeah.
I was able to attend one of Lisa's panels earlier in the week, and one of her fellow panelists kept wondering aloud why she hated America so much. Please help make up for that uncalled-for attack by welcoming Lisa back to CWA. And finally, our last panelist is Mike Reese, who is employed in some fashion in the television industry. Mike, I'm told you may have some kind of involvement with some kind of animation. Sure. Fortunately, Mike does have a book out, Springfield Confidential, which may help explain what he's been doing with that little show for, what, the last couple of years?
30 years.
Oh, yeah, 30 years.
It's also in paperback.
Hardback is more expensive, better royalties. That period with The Simpsons includes his running the show as a showrunner for season 4 in 1993, widely regarded as the finest Simpsons season ever, and many regarded as the finest season of any television series ever. After the panel, I'll be entertaining bids for my personal copy of the DVD box set for season 4. Mike is coming to us from a private meeting with Governor Polis last night, where apparently Polis killed with some Simpsons jokes. It's his first appearance at CWA. It's his first panel here. And please join me in welcoming Mike to what I hope is the first of many trips to Boulder. Mike Reese.
Please stop. 2 days ago, you never heard of me.
It was a week, but okay. Okay, we'll now begin by asking each panelist to make some introductory remarks of about 5 minutes each. And Seth, those are Earth minutes.
They could have been Jovian minutes. Those are even shorter. All right.
Is it?
Okay. Look, we're going to talk about comedy. I'm going to tell you a little bit before I address the question of can it affect social change. I'll tell you a little bit about why people laugh, why humor even exists. Now, you've seen videos, many of you, of other primates who, when tickled, begin to laugh. Right? Chimps do that sort of thing. They grin, they make some heavy breathing sounds. That's when they're being tickled. So, that begins in humans a lot earlier. We're much better at it than the chimps are. Infants 3 or 4 months begin to laugh. They're laughing. And actually, they're my best audiences. I go into the maternity ward. Sorry about that. But, okay, so primates do have this reaction. It's a physiological reaction in the chimps. You're tickling them. It's not that, they appreciate your sense of humor. They just appreciate the tickling, and then they laugh. You notice that fish do not laugh. It's restricted to primates. Okay, well, how did that, turn into humor? Well, eventually, because of our bigger brain, we were able to cause the affect of laughing without actually having to tickle people. If we had to tickle each one of you, or sniff your hair or do something to make you laugh, that would take a long time. So that was the big move, right? All right, in our development. Now, what's the benefit? Right? Now, this is always a question when you look at something that's uniquely human, like laughter, telling jokes in any case. What's the evolutionary benefit of that? It's like music. I've always asked myself, everybody likes music, but how does it help you get your genes into the next generation, right? I always figured Johnny Mathis certainly knew how to do that because he would encourage people to cuddle up. So, I don't know, but there is an evolutionary benefit of humor, and it's this. There was a UCLA study only a couple of years ago in which they played for people, their test subjects, they would play them little snippets of people laughing. In one group, the people laughing were their friends. In the other group, they were strangers. And the folks who were listening could easily tell which were their friends because the laughter had a different quality, a different sonic quality. Sounds odd, but apparently so. So humor has a useful function for your survival, and that is social bonding. We're a social species. So that obviously helps. Okay. Now, That's the obvious benefit. Let me say something else about another benefit. Jeff Miller down at the University of New Mexico has spent a long time studying why it is we got smart. Why did Homo sapiens get smart? You look at our ancestors, you know, they were hairy, but they weren't smart. They weren't smart. And so what did it, right? Why did our brains start getting bigger? And he claims that it's because of mate selection. I've said this before at the CWA. He says, look, the canonical example is the peacock, right? You know, they had this peahen sitting around with her little pea brain, and a peacock comes up and opens up these big blue feathers, and she takes a look at them. You know, they're pretty impressive blue feathers. But then another peacock comes up. You know, it's Melvin, and his blue feathers are a lot more impressive. So she takes him home to mom. Now, what's the benefit in, you know, choosing the guy with the big blue feathers? I mean, it's only going to attract predators, right? But the thing is, maybe that is the benefit. Now I think about it. I don't know. But the point is, growing those blue feathers is very intimately tied into his genome. So it's a marker. It's like the Dow Jones Index. It gives you some idea of the market. That blue feather says, you know, my genome doesn't have too many mistakes in it, the chicks will be healthy. Okay, so that's all there is to it. Now, in our species also, the males display, the females decide. And, of course, we don't have blue feathers, the males in our species, but it turns out that your brain is very intimately tied into your genome. So, you know, the best strategy for men at a party would be to remove their skulls, pass their brain around to all the women. This is considered a social blunder, so they don't do it. But if they can sing, if they can tell jokes, then that's an indication that the genome's wired up correctly. So the fact that the women are listening to what the guy's saying, and if he can sing or tell jokes or something like that, they think, oh, well, that's kind of interesting, that's attractive. It isn't because they like jokes. It isn't because they like clever guys. It's because the chicks will be healthy. Okay, keep that in mind, guys. All right, now. All right, so that's how, you know. This is another thing I might tell you very quickly. Last week for our radio show, I interviewed this woman at Purdue University, Julia Reyes. And the question I asked her is, why does Alexa not laugh at our jokes? And the bottom line was, and by the way, this was a humorless person. I hope she's not. It's true. I hope she's not in the audience. But the real reason is because humor is so hard to define. It's hard to, you know, define it in a way that allows you to algorithmically program it for Alexa. Okay. Could it affect change? Well, music also has a physiological reaction, just like laughter does. Can music affect social change? And I think maybe it can. I'm thinking back on, you know, I don't know, the hippier and so forth. The music certainly had an effect on social values. I think that's still true today. On the other hand, you know, it's not a very clear case. But let me give you one clear case, and then I'll shut up. And that is Thomas Nast. Some of you may have heard of Thomas Nast. He was a cartoonist for Harper's, mostly in the 1870s. And he was a political cartoonist. In fact, he sort of invented political cartoons. And he took on Boss Tweed, William Tweed, in New York, right? Tammany Hall, the whole Democratic machine in New York City. And Tweed was very upset about this. Eventually, he brought down Tweed. That, you know, those cartoons really brought down Tweed. They also affected, by the way, the election of presidents for 40 years. And just with cartoons. Tweed is reported to have said, because he knew that most of the people in New York could not read. They could not read Harper's Bazaar. And so what he said was, stop the damn pictures. Right? Because those pictures, which were satirical and funny, right, those were more effective than the long opinion pieces that were in the magazine. So yes, it looks like it can affect change.
So I'm going to tell you about a personal problem I have, and we'll go from there. Might take my whole time. So I'm a single guy, and I am dating. So in New York City, I go out on these dates. Women in New York City are fairly fancy. I do not fashion myself this way, and they're fairly sophisticated. I am not really sophisticated either. And, you know, go on these dates, you have a good time, and it gets to the end of the night, it gets to this familiar point that you all probably experienced at some point in your life, maybe you're still experiencing it, which is the awkward goodbye. Right? You say goodnight, and it usually starts out with, I had a good time. Yeah, I had a good time too. Yeah. No, both people are thinking intensively. One person might be thinking, I should maybe go in for the kiss. The other person might be thinking, I should go in for the kiss. Or might be thinking, please, dear God, do not kiss me. Right? And that's where the trouble starts. So it gets this point for me. In New York, you know, you're saying goodbye not on the porch. You say goodbye in front of the subway, which is not romantic. And these big yellow neon signs illuminating your pain, social pain, for everybody else to observe. Now, I'm socially awkward, and so I don't pick up on social cues as well as other people. Now, I know this is a bad situation for everybody. I am at the tail end of that distribution of bad. Right? So sometimes afterwards, I'll tell my friends about what happened or didn't happen, in my case, and they'll say, Ty, what was going through your head? I'm like, nothing. Nothing at all. My body was full of panic, but nothing in my mind, you know? And so given the state of affairs, I think there's two options, right? I can hug it out, or I could go for the kiss, and I go the safe route. I'm going to hug it out, right? Okay, good. Now, I get a text then. This has happened actually more than once. It's happened an embarrassing number of times over the past year and a half. I get a text. The woman says, I had a great time. I would love to do this again sometime soon. ! Oh, really? Well, maybe I made the wrong decision. So yeah, well, let's go out again. So we go out again. Christina and I had a good time. I had a good time too. You know. You would think I would learn. You know, intelligent behavior is adapting your behavior to circumstances. Same exact thing. You know, body full of panic, nothing in my head. Hug it out. Same thing. Text message. I had a great time. I would love to do this again soon. ! Third time. Same thing. I'm going to bore you with details. It's the same exact thing. Okay? And I just don't know. I just don't know. My friends are flabbergasted. You know, face palming. And like, Ty, you gotta, clearly, she likes you. You need to. Here's what I've learned, though. They get impatient. So these women get impatient. The third or fourth time this happens, I go to pull away from the hug, and they lock it in. And my slow mind thinks, this is not what friends do, I think. But then it gets a little weirder because this, I don't know where they learned this. But now the hand comes up the back of the head, and now I get pulled in, but not in the way you would think. It goes cheek to cheek. So I'm being pulled very forcefully into their cheek. And now I think, finally, after all of this, I think it's time to make out. You know, I think this is a sign that this might be a good time. Now there's two strategies here. One is you could disengage the cheek and swing back around. That's actually the better strategy, for the record. The second strategy, which I choose to employ, apparently, is a very friction-filled strategy. Which involves slowly and awkwardly moving your cheek across her cheek until you reach... This has happened repeatedly, actually. That's a true story, actually, unfortunately. And to get to a little more of the substance of the matter, though, this is a story I'll tell when I talk to high school students or college students about consent. Because it's a fairly playful and whimsical way, right, to talk about when is it okay to engage in a degree of physicality with somebody. And I found that when I try to go at that topic directly, people just get locked up, right? It's a super serious topic. It's definitely something we need to talk about as a society, but people get locked up. If you come in with some humor at the start, all of a sudden it opens their minds to all kinds of different possibilities and they feel less threatened. We know all this from psychological research, right? You're open, you don't feel threatened. And now people are receptive to a lot of different things and receptive, I think, to a much more complex argument. which is how do you balance things like consent with things like pleasure and things like desire and a need for companionship. So I'm a big fan that we're having this panel and looking forward to what everybody has to say.
Well, I can tell that this is an audience of pessimists. Actually, it's so exciting to see so many people out here, and also the pressure is so intense. But I thought I would just tell three little stories. One is more personal. I'm actually from Colorado, and my last name is Graves, as you may know now. And my grandfather was adopted by this guy named Graves. And so my family had come to Colorado, part of my family had come to Colorado from Boston to organize the tramway workers when Colorado used to have trolleys up and down Broadway. And then the other part of my family, you know, that's a longer story, which I'll tell you over drinks sometime. But anyway, my grandfather was adopted by this man named Graves. And so at some point in, you know, inheritances and things passing along, I ended up with these documents. It turns out that Mr. Graves, the brother of the man who adopted my grandfather, was like a bad Democrat, because I found all these editorial cartoons about him moving polling locations all around Denver. So people couldn't vote. And it was him and Mr. Soji working, I think, to help Mayor Stapleton. You all remember Stapleton Airport back in the day. Apparently, at the turn of the century, that Democratic Party was not really in favor of voting rights. I tell you that now in case everyone for office. You know, I've confessed. I had nothing to do with it. But the thing that really struck me was that in these papers from Mr. Soji and Mr. Graves were ballots. I thought this seems irregular. I don't think we should have ballots. But the most interesting thing about the ballot was back then in the early 1900s when literacy was not so wide, there were many, many parties running for office. It wasn't just this dominated two-party system. And the parties would basically identify themselves by a logo, by a picture, an image. And so I'm looking, there's like the Silver Party, there's a Star Party, there's all these interesting parties. And all of a sudden I realized that the Democratic Party is a chicken. I'm very glad that the current mascot of the Democratic Party isn't a chicken, although occasionally I think, you know, they could be a little bolder. And that's not a pun for bolder. Anyway, so I still have those ballots, but I can't vote with them now. So. Anyway, the other thing in my work, I do a lot of intensive work about the Koch brothers, about these Trump administration appointees. We did a lot of the investigative work looking into Pruitt before he was nominated to be the head of the EPA, and then we tracked him throughout his brief tenure at the EPA. And you know, we were really covering him. He was up to all sorts of no good. But because I'm not a comedy writer, I couldn't even have imagined that this guy would be using Secret Service to go on runs to pick up lotion for his hands, which turns out it wasn't the worst of it. Who, and I know you heard the story, but who in their right mind would go to the Trump Hotel to seek a gift of a used mattress? It's crazy. You can't imagine a nominee who would do such a thing. How is this even in the realm of possibility? So, you know, I look at a lot of Trump's nominees. I've looked at Zinke. We had a lot of work to really expose how corrupted he was. I looked at Betsy DeVos. She had a very interesting background, even beyond marrying into the DeVos family. She was decidedly not funny. I think you may have guessed that by now. But as I looked at person after person after person chosen by Trump, I kept thinking, you know, I don't know what his superpower is, but I think it might be that he has the ability to choose the worst person for every single job possible. And it's not just that, like, they're corrupt or corruptible or they're grifters, and some of them are grifters. It's that literally, like, if you had a room of people, who would be the worst person to put in charge of the Department of Education? The woman who thinks we shouldn't have public schools. Yeah, I mean, that seems like a no-brainer, like, you wouldn't want to do that. But, and so then I was thinking, like, what is this? How does he know that there are going to be people who are doing deals on the side and trying to get money, like when Pruitt was trying to get a job for his wife at Chick-fil-A using staff, like, you know, like, how does he know that they're going to be so bad? And this morning, as I was thinking this through, I thought, you know, like, it's like Gaydar, but it's not Gaydar, because, you know, they're not so friendly. But but I thought, okay, so here's my pun. I thought it's like Nadar. which isn't like nay, but it's like nadir, which is actually pronounced nader, right? N-A-D-I-R, which means the lowest, the bottom, the bottom. He's got nadar. With apologies to Ralph Nader, because that's apparently how nader is pronounced, even though I have been pronouncing it that way my entire life because I'm a book learner. So anyway, I guess the last little bit of humor I'll say, besides saying I am so indebted to the comedy writers in this country for helping me survive the last 2+ years. Absolutely would have gone mad before now had we not had so many tremendous writers, the Colbert Show, Saturday Night Live, Simpsons, Last Week Tonight. I mean, you just name the people who have helped us survive just the shocking chaos of it all. You know, in fact, some of my work involves looking into the Koch brothers, not just their front groups, but also their energy activities, their attacks on attacks on electric vehicles and more, the way that the entities that they fund have been trying to take down wind energy. But even I couldn't even imagine a scenario in which the president would say, you know, that windmills cause cancer. Like, you just, you can't write this stuff. You can't write this stuff. But I will say, with respect to the Koch brothers, I've watched them and I've looked at documents of them from going back to archives from the early 1960s, and they've gotten much better at naming things. One of their first organizations that they created in the 80s, this was actually been naming a bunch of other things, they created this group called Citizens for a Sound Economy. It was them. You know, they're citizens, right? But it was Citizens for a Sound Economy. And they did a lot of no good in that role. But then eventually they sort of got smarter because, you know, they got a lot of money. It's the best PR money could buy. And so they launched, you know, about 15 years ago, Americans for Prosperity. Way better than Citizens for a Sound Economy. But I always tell people that that's because when they polled it, Americans for Greed just didn't poll as well.
These guys killed. They killed. You know, I asked to go last on the panel because I figure, what do we got, a scientist, a lawyer? You know, they're going to stink up the joint and then I'll come in, you know, comedy boy to the rescue. And then they killed, and I'm going, how are they doing it? Why are you loving it so much? And then I realized, it's weed. I just got off the plane. Your atmosphere here is 80% weed. I went outside today. I saw a snowman eating Doritos. It's weed. Anyway, the other reason I wanted to go last was because of this. I was on a panel just like this a few years ago. It was had the same kind of title, Humor, : Can It Change America? You know, and whoever's naming these panels, enough with the colons, okay? Climate change, global disaster, or nice day out, you know? Spam, you know, email or delicious lunch meat. Enough with the colons. So I was on this panel, and it was a panel called Humor, Can It Change Political Thinking? And they flew a bunch of us out to Chicago. It was me, it was Andy Borowitz from The New Yorker, Liz Winstead, the creator of The Daily Show. And they sit us all down, and the moderator goes, well, let's start with the topic. Humor, can it change American politics? And we went down the row and went, no, 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 no. And the moderator went white. She went white. And I mean, she was Nigerian, but she went white. And it's okay. It's like, oh, I'm offended for all the black people here. Where? So, you guys walk out in the snow. You're lost, folks.
I'm getting a glare off of all you people. Anyway, we all said no, 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 no. The moderator went white, and she looks at her watch. She goes, "Well, we still got 88 minutes to fill." I wish comedy could change politics. I wish it could change people's minds. It really does. I mean, all you have to do is look at the president. Don't look directly at him, but look at the president. Look at this guy. The full force of comedy has been hitting this guy. Every humorist in America has been pounding Donald Trump for 3 years since his campaign on. Boom, 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 boom. And it has lowered his approval rating from 41% to 41%. It just doesn't change anything. And it actually, you know, and again, I hate to bring up Donald Trump, as I'm sure his parents did, but... if you come see me tomorrow morning, I'll be telling all the same jokes. So, luckily, many of you are old and will not remember. So, but I remember a time 19 years ago. We were working on The Simpsons, the year 2000, and we were writing a joke, and the setup was, what is the dumbest thing we could imagine America doing? And somebody said, President Trump. A lot of you know this story. It came out that The Simpsons predicted President Trump 16 years before it happened. We said President Trump, the whole room laughed, the writer's room laughed, and I'll never forget this moment. The secretary is about to type it into the script, and she goes, "Do you think it's too dumb?" And the point of this story is, when The Simpsons makes fun of what's going on in the news, that's satire. When the news starts doing things it saw on The Simpsons, that's messed up. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm feeling like that moderator in Chicago. I've got 40 minutes. Obviously, I'm the only one who took this topic seriously. I went out and read articles in the New York Review of Books and came in with quotes, and my whole act has been taken away now. But while I stall for time and try and fashion a question, let me turn to a student question, speaking of The Simpsons' impact. And this is a question for Mike, obviously. How did The Simpsons be able to predict so many laughable events in America years before they even happened?
It's, all right, the Trump thing, that was big. We called it, but again, it was a joke, you know? It was a joke. But the other funny thing, and it goes to a bigger question, I get it from younger people all the time, which is now, how do you predict all this stuff? How do you get it so right? Well, I had to do the math. We do about 100 jokes in every episode of The Simpsons. We've done 650 episodes. That's 65,000 jokes. We got three things right. Three things right. We got Donald Trump. That was a good one. We got Brazil was going to cheat at the World Cup. We predicted that. No brainer. And then we predicted, I think, the U.S. would win the gold medal in curling. And, like, you know, so you can see, they kind of drop off pretty quickly. And so that's it. That is, we get one thing. We've been on for 30 years. We got three things right. We get one prediction right a decade. And that makes us the most reliable psychics in America.
Okay, I've boiled down my New York Review of Books quote into a single quote. This is from a Hungarian author and journalist named Arthur Koestler, who has written the funniest encyclopedia entry on humor, or the funniest encyclopedia entry of any kind, But he was also serious about the impact of humor, and he said that given that there's an insult implicit in humor, it's not surprising that powerful men would seek to thwart those who inspired others to laugh at their expense. Under the tyrannies of Hitler in Germany and of Stalin in the Soviet Union, humor was driven underground, he writes. Dictators fear laughter more than bombs. And yet, I don't think the Third Reich was brought down by humor, and I don't think Stalin was driven out, or Stalinism ended with humor. Seth, I loved your example of Boss Tweed. That's a concrete example of how humor actually brought down one powerful political machine. I'm trying to think of others.
Hmm. Are you looking at me?
I'm looking at y'all. Desperately, I'm looking at y'all.
Yeah, I mean, you can see Trump continues to berate Saturday Night Live, so he's obviously discomfited by the humor there. But the idea that it might bring it down, I think Mike made the point that that's just not going to happen. And so there is some limit to what it can do. But on the other hand, you know, there's an effect. If you have a relentless drumbeat, after a while you begin to like percussion or hate it, right? So, you know, maybe the cumulative effect. But I agree with you. I can't think of another. Can anybody here think of one?
Anthony Weiner.
Was that brought down by humor? I mean, there was... there's something. You know where the word humor comes from. That's Latin for moist. Yeah, for moist. I mean, the four humors of the body, humidity, humidor, all that stuff. Maybe there's a tie in there if you had the right kind of mind.
I do think that the power to capture someone's personality, their identity, whether it's in an editorial cartoon or a Saturday Night Live skit, can really cement things people think about that person's character. It may not be true. Yeah, I remember the sort of attacks on Al Gore in a way, some of the humorous attacks on him at a time when he was fighting to win that race against George Bush. And, you know, some of that humor was true in terms of his stiffness. Some of it was perhaps, you know, overstated as the caricatures go. Did it affect that outcome of that election? You know, lots of things affect the outcome of that election, including the theft of it by the U.S. Supreme Court. But we can talk about that later. But I think that, you know, sometimes some of those portraits can really stick in ways that, you know, hurt a candidate. Sometimes it can stick in ways that sort of help a candidate, make them seem more humorous or maybe minimize some of the seriousness of their policies or positions. So I don't say that to put any stock in this ridiculous idea by some, I think, a Georgia politician who wanted to have some sort of review of the news, some sort of way to have some sort of commission in the U.S. to monitor whether news is news, and Trump's ridiculous claims to that we should suddenly now, because he has the thinnest skin ever and apparently the most Bonesbury feet, that we've got to somehow, you know, police the media and have libel rules because apparently being in cahoots with the National Enquirer and lying to people every week at the checkout counter was not enough for him. He's got to control the outcome of every Saturday Night Live episode, or he wants to somehow have a right to sue them into oblivion through libel. I don't think that'll ever happen. At least if it does, I, like you, will be out of the country, hopefully, if that were to ever take place, if there were ever a majority to do so. But I think that he's sensitive to it because it does sting. And I think for him, perhaps the unfortunate thing, really it's the unfortunate thing for us, is that there's very little parody in those parodies. It literally is almost, you could read almost anything he says in an editorial meeting with the Washington Post or a speech that he gives where, you know, he's unintentionally hilarious. If he weren't in power, it would be a lot more funny.
What about Gerald Ford, Jim?
Oh yeah, Chevy Chase, right? Chevy Chase and the fall down You know,
yeah. Ford was actually not so clumsy. I mean, he was an athlete, right?
Yeah.
Not sure that cost him the election, but
yeah.
Sarah Palin, funny, funny lady.
Sarah Palin, you know, it is worth mentioning. Nobody remembered Sarah. Well, maybe you will remember when Sarah Palin was named the nominee. She came out. This is the first time any of us had ever seen her, and she also killed. She gave a hilarious speech. It was like a roast of Obama and the Democrats. She was genuinely funny. And that didn't help her any either. It's, I'm telling you, I wish it changed things. I wish it did. And I just don't think it does. But it's what you mentioned. If nothing else, it gives you comfort. You know, when you hear these jokes about Trump, you're not changing anything, but you go, at least this guy, it's Colbert, whoever, John Oliver, he thinks like me. Oh, thank goodness I'm not alone here. And sometimes that's the best thing humor can do. I can say this from personal experience. When I was a little boy, I grew up in a small town in Connecticut where we were the only Jewish family. And by the way, still my mother would say, I only want you to date Jewish girls. And I was like... And so I said, well, Mom, looks like it's going to have to be you. So, so I dated my mom for a few months. And we got along fine, but her kids hated me. But seriously, I have to say I felt very isolated and awkward and weird in this town in Connecticut. And then I was a little boy, and I was 6 years old, little boy watching the Ed Sullivan Show with the family, and Woody Allen came on, and he's doing stand-up. And I'm listening to this neurotic Jewish intellectual, and I'm going, this guy gets me. Now, I should just take that. I mean, mind you, I may not be the only six-year-old Woody Allen got, but that's... And take it away.
All right. Too soon?
You know, the thing about politicians, though, is like Sarah Palin, you know, when Katie Kirk asked her that question, what do you read? What newspapers do you read? She didn't ask that as a setup. That wasn't like the liberal media trying to catch her. Yeah. That was like a genuine question. What newspapers do you read? And she was like, all of them. You know, I mean, that's a genuine comedic moment. I'm impressed that Katie didn't laugh out loud. You know, she held her composure. You know, in some ways, I was thinking about some of these politicians that have come before Trump and how they sort of paved the path for him. I remember when Dan Quayle was chosen for George Herbert Walker Bush's vice president. I remember thinking, he's just not very bright. And it wasn't just the tomatoes thing, toes thing, but it was, he just wasn't very bright. And then, you know, I kind of thought that was sort of mysterious. Was it some sort of impeachment insurance policy after Iran-Contra, you know? Well, we can't impeach George Herbert Walker Bush because we'll end up with Quayle. I thought that's a possibility. And then when George W. Bush ran for office, I was like, oh, reminds him of his son. Yeah. But, you know, back to Sarah Palin, the thing that really struck me about her was that, you know, she's in Alaska, and it's not just that she can see Russia from her front door or nearby or the coast. But, you know, to take a sort of serious note, but in reality, like, you know, she was an active denier of climate change. You know, she's famous for saying, drill, baby, drill. Her husband got rich off of the BP oil fields up there. You know, she sort of sold out her brief term in office. Thank goodness it was brief. But, you know, when you think about Alaska, you know, it's one thing for people in, like, you know, I don't know, Georgia or Tennessee or something to think, well, I'm not really affected by climate change that much. Let's take Tennessee. Not a coastal community. Temperatures haven't risen that much. They don't have glaciers. They're not melting. But, you know, in Alaska, when permafrost is no longer perma, I think you got to confess that climate change is happening.
So I have a student question that I'm going to direct to Ty, because it talks not just about social change, but interpersonal change. So can humor be used as a powerful force in the discussion of uncomfortable and controversial topics to eliminate some tension and violence often present in these discussions? What caution should be used in relation to that?
That's a great question, whoever asked that. Yes, and I'll give you just a little bit of the data on that, actually. So emotions, they feel a certain way, right? That's usually how we think about them, but they actually function. If you think about why we would keep emotions as a species and have that passed down from generation to generation, it becomes an interesting question. And the answer is because they make us think in a certain way and behave in a certain way that matches the demands of the situation. So if you're fearful, for example, your attention narrows to whatever the threat is, and you're likely to either freeze or flee. If you're angry, your attention once again narrows, and now you're likely to probably aggress. And there's all these physiological changes that happen in conjunction with your mind to make these things happen in milliseconds. It's really remarkable to think about. Now, in the past 20 years, psychologists finally started studying positive emotions. We've been focused on negative for so long. And it's a fascinating body of work, and what they find is that when people are in a positive emotional state, they are much more likely to expand their cognitive focus, to expand their attention. They're more open to unusual and new ideas, and as a result, they're more creative. So people in the positive emotional state combine now, right, this richness of information in unusual ways. So that's a very astute question, because that's exactly what the science has found, is that it can, one, disarm and show people this is not a threatening situation. That's what communicates. Number two, makes more information available, makes you more receptive to new information, and now you can combine those in ways that would have been impossible in a neutral or a negative state. So when it comes to reducing tension and trying to find tiny steps forward, I think there is evidence that it can help. Now, when it comes to taking down a president or swinging an election, I totally agree with the panel. I think it's probably limited in that regard. But I've been such a big fan of what comedy has done for social change in our interpersonal relationships, right? One of the few places we can talk about race honestly now, I think, is with comedy. And it's a great way for people to communicate things that are actually very painful, right, and very oppressive, but in a way that we can handle. And then before you know it, you have been educated, even though you didn't want to be, right? And it's like the pill and the cupcake kind of strategy.
Yeah. I think... Got any cupcakes? Yeah, I think that's very true. Obviously, humor disarms the audience, and as mentioned earlier, it's also it cements social bonds. I wanted to say something about emotions. You know, Marvin Minsky did a lot on emotions, and I think I was just sitting here thinking as you were talking, Ty, that probably emotions are the result of Newtonian physics. You may not buy into that, but let me suggest because your brain works very slowly. Some of my brother's brains work really. I mean. It's like continental drift. Your brain works slowly. For you to actually recognize that a situation requires a quick response, you know, you put your hand on the stove or there's a giant cat coming your way, you don't have time to reason about that. So emotions are, in fact, a shortcut in the software to get you to react very, very quickly. And why I say Newtonian physics is because, you know, that determines how fast cats can jump and, you know, put their claws in you. And so that probably determines how fast the emotions work because your brain is very slow, right? The connection speed is very slow. So maybe that's it. We have all these emotions to react quickly, right? My roommate had a theory about why men are attracted to attractive women. And he said, look, you know, 100,000 years ago, these guys go out there looking for women. They walk into a cave. There are a bunch of women there, right? But the guys that are attached to these women, they might come back from the hunt. So they don't have a whole lot of time to make a decision. They can't talk to all these women and say, hey, look, you know, do you play the piano? Maybe you speak Bosnian or Herzegovinian dialect or something. They don't have time for any of that, right? So they look at the woman and say, oh, you know, her eyes are sort of close together. Well, that's kind of interesting. No, her eyes are far apart. Well, that's kind of interesting. No, I'm going to go for the one where the eyes are sort of average distance apart, because that's genetically safe, right? There's the one with the big boobs, that's new, small boobs. I'll go for the one that's sort of average, right? So it was my roommate's theory that if you took all the women in the world, made photos of them, and then averaged them together in software, you would get, you know, the cover of Glamour magazine or something like that. I think he was right. I don't know what this has to do with.
He was right. Yeah.
Seth may have anticipated the next audience question. Was there anything funny about Brett Kavanaugh? I thought you just answered that.
Yeah, I thought Brett Kavanaugh gave new meaning to the phrase sober as a judge.
Very nice. Very nice.
I can't top that.
But Lisa, you are the law talking panelist here, and so I have a law question from a student. Do you think that there should be censorship of comedy, and can jokes go too far?
Oh my goodness, I think there should be absolutely no censorship of comedy, but I do think if you tell a joke that really offends a lot of people, they might get offended. You know, that's just the way it works. They might really dislike you. That's just the way the universe works. I don't think there should be any restrictions on comedy in that way. I do think people pay a social cost if they, you know, if they're sort of an insult comic, I guess unless you're president, you know, it's a little harder of a gambit these days, a little harder of a tour for some of those folks. If you're sort of a racist comic, you're maybe not booked as often because, you know, racism is bad. In case some of you didn't get the memo, I think you probably all did, but I also think that it's the case that on some of these issues, people can use humor to disarm and also open people's minds to issues like privilege or issues, other serious issues. I'm an enormous fan of the late George Carlin. I remember growing up listening to his comedy albums, also Richard Pryor's. My parents really weren't censoring my use of records back in the day for the students, you know, those vinyl things. So I listened to a lot of what I guess would be called blue comedy, but, you know, Carlin was a genius at describing kind of the way government tries to shape our language and rejecting that. And he had a bunch of other great skits that I enjoyed tremendously. So I absolutely reject the idea of censoring comedians. And also, I think there's a part of this that you've mentioned at the beginning, which is, you know, the arts are really important for our humanity. And they're also important, I do think they're important for social change, although gauging that empirically is difficult. But, you know, one of my favorite photos is Woody Guthrie with his guitar. This is a, you know, fascism-killing machine. We need music and we need humor to survive dark times and to help us transmit those lessons to ourselves, reinforce them, and to others.
I'm going to go to a point, and I'm dead serious on this. I'm not going for any laughs here. But it's just true. It's what I've experienced, what's going on in the world, which is I've done a lot of public speaking. I've given 500 speeches in 22 countries, Israel and India, China, Chile, Qatar, something else that begins with Q, Cuba, and... But it took me a while. It took me about 5 years of speaking until I got a bulletproof speech. A speech that, just true, funny anecdotes that made every audience laugh in all these countries. And I gave it at Ivy League schools and Texas schools and churches and synagogues and nursing homes. It always worked until about 3 years ago. And then just slowly, people stopped laughing and started gasping. And I know they weren't. I wasn't offending them, but they would just sit there in the audience going, this might offend someone I know. People were stop having fun all the time. They just weren't laughing. And I'm sitting there going, wow, I can't blame it on Trump or global warming. These are my people. These are the liberals, the people who vote like me, are just suddenly not wanting to have fun anymore, not getting context on a joke, focusing on a word in a joke instead of the bigger picture. And I thought it was just me. And then I saw a beautiful tweet the other day, because that's the kind of heavy reading I do. Once they went to 280 characters, I was like, check, please. And But someone raised the question, which I have to agree with. They said, how can a generation raised on South Park be so sensitive?
That's it. Mikey. you realize you're in the home of South Park here. So speaking of audiences being offended, we've accomplished that because I have the following question that I'm going to direct to Seth. What is at his request, okay? What is wrong with you people? Don't you know that the Conference on World Affairs is a serious quantum physics endeavor?
I just want to remind you of Nick Bostrom, philosopher at Oxford, who has said in many ways and in many venues that there's a 20% chance that you are not a real audience, that this is code being run in a computer of the future. Okay? And I think that gives you the freedom to act in any way you want, right? Because it's just code and it doesn't matter.
Do you want the red pill or the blue pill?
It's like the red wire and the blue wire.
These are kind of combined student questions. What if someone perceives humor as negative? And since you said comedy can disarm the audience towards a certain threat, doesn't that mean that jokes about serious, unacceptable subjects, rape or domestic violence, might become more underrated or not treated with enough attention? It's a negative effect of humor. The desensitizing effect, perhaps.
Could you repeat the first part of that question?
The first question was, what if someone perceives humor as negative?
I was going to say they need to get a sense of humor. Sorry, couldn't resist.
There's always somebody, right? I mean, you know, this is probably happening to everybody up here if they're as neurotic as me. But there could be 299 people laughing at something. I will somehow find the one person who's stone-faced.
Yeah,
that was pretty good, you know? How could you not? And so there's always somebody. And I think of it in a kind of cost-benefit way. And is this the kind of the greatest good for the most number of people? And it's a pretty simplistic way to think philosophically, but I do think there's something to be said for that. If we get so afraid, right, that we're going to offend somebody or that we're going to offend somebody else, you know, who we're sitting next to or whatever, it robs us, the cost of that is it robs us of an opportunity to have an honest conversation about things that are hard and uncomfortable. You know, there's a difference between being offensive and being uncomfortable. I'm a big fan, you know, being awkward, I'm a big fan of making things uncomfortable because, of course, that's where the growth is going to occur. So I think you do have to be careful. And I forgot to answer this from the previous question, too, though. All that being said, it's very easy, of course, to make a bad joke that hurts somebody else, that is not funny, and is mean-spirited. So you got to be careful. You got to know yourself and what your voice is perceived like. You got to know your audience a bit, and you got to know the times, too, and the cultural zeitgeist that you're living in. And I think if you know those things and the intent is good, the intent is to bring joy to folks, or the intent is to make a point about a social issue or social change, I think, you know, 9 times out of 10, things are going to go a good direction.
I'm going to tell you, it's a true story. This is I gave a speech a few years before people got all that sensitive, maybe 10 years ago, and I thought it went great. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and said, "You made a joke about Texas, and I didn't think it was so funny." And I thought, well, maybe you didn't get it. And but... But it goes to this point where I said to her, I mean, I was a little taken aback. I said, yeah, I made a joke about Texas, but I also made a joke about Jewish people, gay people, the North. I made jokes about Bill Clinton. I made jokes about Michael Jackson. I made a lot of jokes about myself. Did those bother you? And she said, no, just the one about Texas. And I couldn't convince her, you know, that maybe things are bigger than her. And she said, and she just storms out. She goes, you know, Mr. Rice, she pronounced my name wrong. So, okay, great. You know, Mr. Rice, you don't burn brighter by blowing out someone else's candle. And I said, well, you kind of do. I
I told a pretty offensive joke once, although, of course, I didn't think it was offensive. I was going to a concert at Wolf Trap near Virginia, and my friend who I was meeting, he was running late with his girlfriend, so he asked me to pick up his friend and his friend's girlfriend. And so I don't know who these people are. They get in my car, you know, a progressive, even though I'm, you know, a serious lawyer a lot of the time. And we end up driving on what was called Jefferson Davis Highway, you know, the former president of the old Confederacy. And I really am so offended myself at that name, that we would actually name a highway after Jefferson Davis. And so, you know, I'm driving, you know, I'm on a roll, you know. We don't name highways after, you know, Osama bin Laden. You know, he killed a lot of people, you know, that would be wrong. And, you know, Jefferson Davis, head of the Confederacy, the Confederate War, killed more Americans, you know, than any of these Islamic terrorists. Not that they're the same, but, like, really, we should not have, why are all these roads named after these Confederates? I just can't believe it. We won that war. How is this possible? You know, if you're a Southerner, you're already really offended right now. I'm really sorry. I'm confessing. It's true confessions. But, you know, at some point in my comedic riff, I noticed that there's no laughter coming from the back. Because I'm way down the path. Like, there's no point of no return here. And then I go, so, where are you from? And she says, Alabama. I'm just like, well, we're going to have to agree to disagree. Silence to the concert the rest of the way. So, lesson learned, know your audience.
We have an audience suggestion for next year's panel topic, and I think Mike inspired this. Comedy, : its role in foreign policy. And the follow-up question is, should the CIA be planting comedians in China and Russia?
Say it again. What was it?
Should the answer to our foreign policy role be to plant comedians in China and Russia?
Yeah. I think that brings up a point.
I think they should start with Carrot Top and just get them the hell out of here.
Yeah, a point germane perhaps to the topic of this conference might be the fact that you notice that in really repressive regimes, comedy is not very prevalent. And that suggests that actually comedy can affect the outcomes in a country. So maybe that's an existence proof right there.
Hmm. Hmm. You got a warm round of hmm.
In my defense, they have changed the names of the highways in the last couple of years in Virginia.
I used to live on Jefferson Davis Highway. I just want you to know.
I'll make this the final question, and it's for Mike.
Oh.
What do you do?
I was doing so great. I still got time to lose the crowd.
No. Total softball.
Okay.
What do you do when you just don't feel funny?
Oh, well, that's a great question. And the answer is, you know, comedy writers, you don't have that ability. You don't have... You know, that's your job. You gotta be funny. You know, if you don't feel funny, get a different job. And, you know, it's like people, because they ask it of all us writers, what if you have writer's block? Only writers have that excuse, writer's block. You know, a plumber doesn't come to your house. And, He doesn't say, I can't fix your toilet. I got plumber's block. And I still got time to lose you. An accountant doesn't have time to say, he'll never say, I can't do your taxes, man. I have H&R block. Wow.